Büstewelle 96.6. Nu kann man nu ist live am Mittwochnachmittag. Wir begrüßen Justin Sullivan hier im Studio. Mittwochabend Konzert im Sudhaus. Mittwochnachmittag Interview bei der Wüstenwelle. So muss es sein. It's a pleasure to say hello to Justin Sullivan.
Hello.
Hello.
It's a pleasure to be here deep in the beautiful forest.
Yeah, but you told before you don't remember anything of Tübingen. Is it true? Is it really true?
It might come back to me later.
And you also told us this is your morning voice. How does your evening voice sound? Come to the show, you will hear it.
Yeah, it's a little bit less croaky. Yeah.
I thought this is kind of a prejudice that all musicians get up at 2 p.m. and stay up all night.
No. I know some musicians that are real morning people. Both the drummers that I've worked with over the years, Inimurlami, Robert and Michael, they're both really morning people. They play best in the morning. They get up very early and they play best in the morning. And they create best in the morning. I'm a nighttime person. If I'm left alone, which of course last year we were all left alone, I naturally become nocturnal. I kind of like the night because everything stops and then you're just kind of left. No one bothers you with emails or phone calls or messages or there's nothing you got to do. The world's asleep and then you can kind of work and go in. Yeah.
What's your favorite job doing at night time? What are you doing?
I like to be in a studio on my own all night. This is what I like. It's just playing and messing and coming up with ideas and being lost in my own little world.
So if you like when everything stops, you liked the lockdown?
I didn't mind the lockdown. I mean, the thing about the lockdown is that the government said, oh, we're all in it together. But of course, we're not in it together, because if you live in a nice house in the countryside with a big garden and you're not worried about money, then I think for those kind of people, it's been heaven, actually. You know, all this unexpected time to spend with their garden or their children or their dogs or, you know, time to think, read, you know, the sort of. But on the other hand, if you live on the 17th floor in an overcrowded apartment with people you don't love very much and you're worried about money, then it's been really hard for people.
Yeah, of course. And then, but how much did COVID-19 influence you and your work? Like, concerts couldn't take place, probably?
How much did it influence me? I once did a solo album years ago, which I had kind of planned, and it happened directly after 9/11, and the whole world went completely mad talking about 9/11 and vengeance and all the great threat of the axis of evil and all that Bush nonsense, and I wanted to the most intelligent article I ever read about 9/11 was an American journalist written a month later, and he said on the 11th of September 2001, apples ripened on the trees, children were born, the tide came in. There's kind of a sense of perspective on everything. And then this time, lockdown started, and someone phoned me up and said, you will make a solo album. And I went, no, I won't. I have no intention of making a solo album. But I was there on the sofa with a guitar, and so one thing led to another. I spent most of last year making a solo album. I wrote it quite fast, and then I quite quickly got a bit bored of me and a guitar. So I sent the songs round to various friends I have around Europe who play cellos and violins and harps and bass and things, and they sent all the way through last summer. It was a bit like Christmas when I was getting an email attachment with an idea for something to add to the songs. But they never knew what each other was doing. That was the interesting thing. I got all these, they were just playing to my song, and then I would get all these different ideas from different people, and then sort of put it together in November and sort of finish the album. Then I thought, oh, I'll learn to make videos. So I made some videos. For me, it was nice. Okay. I spent time in Paris. My girlfriend lives in Paris. First time I've actually just been able to spend weeks there together.
Amazing. So you also got new ideas and new chances maybe due to the lockdown.
Yeah, and I didn't really want to write about COVID. I mean, there's nothing to say, really. You know, it's a virus. They're common. You know, trees have viruses. Wasps have viruses. Perhaps it's a reminder to everybody that we're not alone on the planet and that perhaps we're not in control of everything. Like people think we should be in control. But we're not, because we share the planet with other things. So I keep thinking about the virus, and you know, perhaps it'll be a bit like Spanish flu. You know, two and a half years they had lockdowns. They have, you know, they had 20 million deaths, but then they didn't have a vaccine, and we've had what, 2.5 million so far, and maybe after 2 years, 2.5 years, it'll peter out. Hope. But there's not much to say about it, so I went off into sort of my imagination of writing songs about other things and people and places. And
yes, it's, the album is called Surrounded. So, what was your surrounding?
Well, we are, aren't we? We're all surrounded by stuff, life, people, nature. I just took the word out of a. I kind of just like the word, really, because we are all surrounded. But, you know, and stories. I tend to write songs with stories. The last one that you just played is a possible version that I read of what happened to Flight MH370. We will never know for sure, but quite a lot of information came much later. After the plane disappeared, there was Malaysian Airlines were extremely unhelpful, but all this other secondary information started to come. And so I wrote a song about what it might well have been. A very strange story.
So writing a song about hundreds of people dying, also a song of crisis. So solo albums appear out of crisis, and the songs also do.
No, I just like stories. I mean, everybody's interested in mysteries, aren't they? So what happened to this plane and all the people? What happened? So I read a lot about it, and I wrote a song. From the point of view of the pilot who killed everybody, why not?
But you said nature, places, people are surrounded. We are all surrounded, but nature plays a special role, doesn't it? Or what role does nature play
in
writing or in your song?
Well, everything. You know, I'm a bit of nature. Here we are looking out the window, there's trees, and there's another bit of nature. And I'm staring across at you, lovely three people, and you're all another little bit of nature. And the virus is another little bit of nature. But human beings have got this extraordinary sort of gene of somewhere. I think it's the vanity gene that somehow, because we have the ability to alter our environment to suit ourselves. You know, we develop these skills and tools and handed on skills and tools and memories and so on, that we think somehow we should be in control of it all, which is a kind of joke, really, to me. It's like, because we're not in control of ourselves, let alone the planet, you know. You know, how much of what you do in a day is your active will, where your intelligence dictates what you do, or how much is just instinct? You just do it. It's part of your nature. You know, we're all a little bit of nature. We come from it, we go back to it. Easy enough. It's quite a miracle, really. I mean, you know.
Yeah, of course. But then how do you get your inspiration for your songs? Like, do you go out, walk in nature, or...
No, I don't write directly about nature. I don't sort of go, oh, I'm going to walk in... Actually, there is one song on the album about the sea. But mostly, I don't go walking in the woods and write about the woods. It's just that I see parallel between... parallels between all the different aspects of nature. And I kind of like using nature imagery to illustrate something. Sort of makes sense to me. But mostly the stories are... You know, you write a song about, stories, people. Sometimes somebody I know, and I'll write a kind of study of the person. or you get try to get inside their heads. On this album, there are four or five songs about me, and that's quite rare. I try not to write too much about myself, but out of the 16 songs, yeah, there are some about me, but mostly about other people or places, and just feelings and.
Which place you feature
on the album? There's one about Belfast, where I lived when I was 20. There's one about a trip I did around America when I was a kid. There's one about Corsica. Just places you go that leave a very strong impression.
And what did you write about you?
What did I write about me? I wrote one love song. I wrote one song which is the first verse. I've always loved snowy, empty, crazy, you know, cold landscapes. And the last New Model Army album, we went off to an island in Norway. We made it in a Norwegian island in an amazing studio which was right on the water. So we could see the tide coming in and out and the snow melting on the mountains and on the beach. And I started writing this song when I was there. And then the second verse is about my grandfather, who I sadly never knew, who was born in Canada and was in love with the snowy wastes of Canada and used to write about it. Sadly, he died before I was born, but somewhere in the blood, I think, this love of bleak, cold, snowy landscapes. I think if you said to some bands, where would you most like to record? They would say, oh, we want to go to New York where it's all happening. Or we want to go to a Caribbean island where it's warm and comfortable and beautiful. And if you said to the five members of New Model Army, where would you most like to record? It would have been there, somewhere bleak, cold, massive and empty, where you have a sense of how important you are in the world, which is exactly zero. And we're all kind of very attracted to those kind of landscapes.
Where does that come from, this kind of...
Don't know.
Search for longing for the cold?
Don't know.
And one thing is the story you're writing about a song, but the other thing is the, well, kind of poetic putting together the single words and having the poetic kind of part, the playing with the language. This is also... an important part of impression or expression.
Yeah, it's nice to to try to write not in the same in a too obvious a way. I've got my own sort of way of writing. Like I say, it's all playing with language or using bits of stories again. Most of my songs have got weather in them. It's not only because I'm English and obsessed with the weather. it's also because if you have weather and light and time of day and place, then as soon as the person's listening to it is somewhere, you're going somewhere. And I think it's really, I like lyrics like that. I like if I listen to a lyric, I like to have pictures. And so all the songs are kind of constructed a little bit like little movies where you have got pictures. I'm not very interested in very abstract lyrics about the inside of the writer's brain. I sort of want to go out and sort of see something in your imagination. It's a little bit like I really love radio plays, and sometimes more than films, because you make your own pictures. It's more personal to you. When you listen, like being a child and being read a story. We were talking about this the other night in the gig and about German folk stories. All these famous German stories that have gone around the world, really, because they're great stories. They're always about being lost in the forest, eaten by wolves or monsters or scary grandmothers or, one thing turning into something else and being lost in the forest. And they're very scary, often very violent. It's quite interesting in this kind of weird new world that we live in, which is on one side extremely brutal and on the other side extremely sentimental, which is some American combination. It's horrible. And you get this sort of idea that children should be protected, shouldn't be read these stories. They're so violent and brutal, and you know, we should protect children from this terrible darkness, which is nonsense. And you should read children these stories because they're about fear and the management of fear, which children start at an early age. So, but it's different from showing children like a horror movie, like a graphic horror movie. You definitely shouldn't, because that puts images into somebody else's images into their brain. But if you basically read them a story, then they create their own images, and it's a way by which children learn to manage fear and the dark side of life, which there is.
German fairy tales from the Brothers Grimm are...
We all grew up with them. I think all over Europe, perhaps all over the world, really. I mean, because they're great stories, and they are, for children, they are about managing. They're scary. And so you, as a child, you're basically learning to manage your own fear, which is a very important part of growing up.
You were a collector, so you are collecting stories also? No, you're writing by yourself, no?
People think I'm really intellectual and I read a lot, and I don't, because I'm so lazy and I'm not even very clever. I'm just very good at taking bits of information from other people. And for many years I lived with a poet called Jules Denby, who's also an artist who's done all the art for New Malami Records over the years. And she was a voracious reader, and she would tell me what was in the books, and then I could pretend that I'd read them.
Justin, playing solo is very different from playing with four lads in your back.
Yeah, what, very different.
How do you, cope with that lack?
There's things I like the fact you can change what you're doing as you go along. And you go at your own speed, and you can stop and tell stories, and you can kind of, and it's very personal. The things I don't like, it's very strange going off stage into an empty dressing room. I'm really not used to that. And the other thing with a band, actually, is that sometimes you can take a minute or two to coast. Because if you know, every great rock band it's really about the drummer and the bass player. You know, it really doesn't matter about anybody else. It's all about the drums and bass. And sometimes it just feels like all I'm doing is steering a truck downhill, and all the power and the energy is from behind me. You know, if you've got a great rhythm section, then it just goes, and I'm just kind of steering it. Whereas when you play alone, you have to generate all the energy yourself, and you can't kind of switch off for 30 seconds. You kind of have to be there. It's sort of less physically tiring and more mentally tiring, but I like both. And I love that kind of very primal thing of, you know, rock and roll. But I also love, you know, telling stories.
Stripped down to the basic.
Yeah.
And traveling without just one car.
Yeah, just my very, very old car, which has now come up to 400,000 kilometres and still going great. Just me and Daz. Daz kind of does some of the driving and looks after me and does the sound and does everything, really. It's very easy for me. I kind of like it.
And what about the Brexit? How does that affect you?
Fucking Brexit. For the band, it's going to be a nightmare, but we haven't really had to cross the bridge yet. We know it's going to be a nightmare. It's going to be really complicated. It's going to be expensive and just really annoying. Ask me in a year. But, I mean, it's, you know, everybody knew Brexit was nonsense. It's nonsense.
You talked about spending some time in your childhood in Belfast. So how did this influence you?
It's a long time ago now. I lived there when I was 20.
But looking at it right now, it's a really a hot place concerning the border between Ireland and
Well, that's another sort of nonsense of Brexit, because it was always going to create this problem that we are now, and the sort of, you know, the people like Joel, the Brexiteers, they just wanted to pretend it wasn't going to happen. And of course, yeah. You know, now how here it is. What is the answer? No idea. I'm sure that in 100 years, Ireland will be one country, but I'm not sure how fast it'll get there. I mean, of course, the people in the South, in the Republic, they will always say that they want a united Ireland. It should be a united Ireland. But they're not really sure that they want 1 million belligerent unionists heavily armed in their country. So it's a sort of, you know, one of those many accidents of history. I mean, that happens with... It's one of the effects of imperialism, is that the imperialists go out and they move people around and they draw borders which don't bear any sort of resemblance to borders that might have been there before they came. I mean, particularly the European powers in the Middle East and Africa, where the Europeans went in and draw lines in the sand. Right, we'll call this Syria. We'll call this Iraq. We'll call this Lebanon. We'll call this, but they're not countries in the way that the West sort of imagined. They were all different localities within, you know, different city states, or, you know, within the Ottoman Empire or whatever.
So, when you wrote about Belfast in one of your songs, the Brexit was not your focus. It was like your happy place from your childhood.
It was more a personal memory of something that happened when I was there in the mid 70s. Okay. You know, during the Troubles, and it was something particular that happened. But it's also an impression of Ireland. I mean, I always feel quite at home in Ireland. I have an Irish name, but my great grandfather left Ireland, went to Canada. So, which is where my father was born. So, you know, I'm sort of nominally Irish somewhere. Maybe I should try to get an Irish passport, then I won't be Brexit-proof. I don't know.
Yeah, this you're talking about borders, new borders. On the one hand, the people are longing for a united Europe, but you talk about colonialism, imperialism, and this show is about, migration refugees are joining us here in the show, conquering the media, but this kind of migration and refugee movements in our times, what's your position, your perspective
on this?
Well, the
movement of people is as old as the hills. I mean, you know, there have always been people moving, which is why, you know, sort of the nationalisms are kind of nonsense anyway, because we're all from everywhere, especially the British. I mean, you know, it's just like we're all very much from everywhere. But it's a little bit, I was, you know, sort of somebody said to me, because I live in Bradford, which is, it's a strange town. It's a 19th century boom town. Before 1900, there wasn't much there. And then in the 19th century, it turned into a really big city built on the wool trade. And in 1910, apparently, it was the richest city head for head in Europe. If any gentleman in Europe was wearing a woolen suit, it was probably made in Bradford. And then towards the end of... after the Second World War, the bottom started to fall out of the textile industry. Lots of people, predominantly from Pakistan, arrived in Bradford, and now there's second, third generation of people that came. I mean, the people from Bangladesh and Jamaica and all these other sort of British colonies, but particularly in Bradford, particularly Pakistan. And then when the kind of great panic about Islam sort of 15 years ago, but I remember, you know, people would say, well, you live in a city which is one third Muslim. So what do the Muslims think about this? And it's a sort of stupid question. You know, if there's 100,000 Muslims in Bradford, there's 100,000 different opinions, just like anyone else. And somebody said, you know, to me, you know, that a few years ago, you know, Germany took in a large number of refugees, predominantly Syrian. You know, what has happened to all the refugees that came to Germany? Well, I'm sure there's a million different stories. You know, just like people are people. Some people sort of find a new life in the place they've moved to quite successfully. They're lucky. Other people find it very difficult. Will they always miss home? Yes. Will they plan to go back? Yes. Except that as soon as they've had children here, this is what happened in Bradford, is that the Pakistani men, predominantly men, came to work and then go home. I know lots of second, third generation Pakistani friends whose parents spent, you know, saved up money, built their retirement home back in Pakistan to return in their old age. But actually, they've now lived in Bradford 50 years. They go back and it's no longer their home. And more to the point, they have children. And to the children, the new place is their home. That's what they know. You know, they have their friends and they go back to the old country. Why? You know, so if presumably if you have refugees in Germany from Syria, if they have children, then the children grow up in Germany, they have friends here, they know here, they don't know anything about Syria, really. Will they, the older generation might want to go back, the younger generation, probably not. But then again, every story is different, every family is different. So, you know, people are... I find it interesting that wherever you have people, communities of people, you always seem to have the same combinations of people. And it doesn't really matter how rich or poor they are. It doesn't matter about religion or history or politics or anything. You always get, you know, the one that's always ill, and you get the one that's always lucky, and you get the one that's always complaining, and you get the one that's, you know what I mean? There's a sort of balance of people. As if, and it's the same thing in nature that you find, you find all these kind of balances of things. I always think about music as well, that if you look at where the darkest, most sort of deliberately ugly, negative anti-music comes from, it often usually comes from places where life's pretty easy and civilized. Scandinavia. You know, metal. You know, the death metal comes from Scandinavia, really, where life is fairly easy. If you look at where the happiest music comes from, it usually comes from the darkest places where life is cheap and people are scared and people's lives are very difficult. So they want that. It's the quest for balance. If your life is easy, you want something from the dark side, and if your life is dark, then you want some light. And this balance, that I think people are like that.
On which side is your music?
I think our music has got... it's a common... I mean, this is generalisation. We've written some happy songs, but I like minor keys. So mostly it's quite sad or dark or melancholic. Sometimes kind of violent... But in art, I've always liked this combination of violence and beauty. Like a Van Gogh painting. Violence and beauty. And I've always loved that in art. And I like that in music. I've never really liked things that are ugly. I know there's a lot of ugly music made in the world, ugly art. And people say, oh, they are the artists or the musicians say they are reflecting what they see or... And I always think that I don't see the point in making something ugly, especially if you're surrounded by ugly things. Like, you know, I want to make something beautiful, but I also like stuff which is a little bit dark and a little bit violent.
I read about that you don't like your voice. What you don't like about your voice?
I once read somewhere that Aretha Franklin doesn't like her voice. So I mean, I don't think I'm. No, no, I hate my voice. Well, no, I don't hate it. But it's interesting that sometimes I write things. I never hear me when I write. So sometimes by accident, I write things that suit my voice. And sometimes I write things and I think, I listen to it and I go, oh, somebody else should have sung that. I don't have a very naturally, you know, tuneful voice. No, I don't. Voices are interesting, aren't they? I mean, if you're a musician and you want to sound a bit like Jimi Hendrix, if you study and play and listen and practice and study and practice, you can sound a little bit like Jimi Hendrix. If I want to sound like Otis Redding, I can't. I will never sound like Otis Redding. God gave me a certain voice, and that's what I've got. And you learn to live with it, and you sort of learn what it does and what it doesn't do. But I don't terribly like it, no. I mean, I always think it's a bit strange, you know, playing guitar and singing, because I know some people that do this when they play alone, and they're really good guitar players and really great singers. And I'm neither. I'm not a great singer. I'm really not a good guitar player. But I can write. And I guess that, you know, if I have a talent, it's that.
Do you listen to your songs yourself in your free time?
Occasionally. Occasionally, I'll go back and listen to an album from a long time ago. When you finish an album, don't want to hear, can't listen to it for a year, at least a year, because all you can hear is the things you wish you'd done differently and better. I would never finish an album. I need to be surrounded by people going, now it's finished. And the moment it's finished, I lose interest in it. It's kind of done. And I really don't want to hear it. But then like a year, 2 years later, maybe I'll listen. And then I can maybe hear it without thinking, oh, I wish I'd done that differently, or I wish I'd done that differently, or, you know, it could always be better.
What else you're listening to?
I'm very eclectic about music. I think like most people that love music, I listen to all sorts of things. Actually, the thing that I listen to most is a French radio station called FIP. So I shouldn't be on your radio station promoting another radio station, but it seems that I am, which is, I think it's government-assisted in France. And it basically plays 24 hours a day music in any genre from any time, from 1920 to released yesterday, all mixed up. But it's not chosen by an algorithm. It's chosen by people who listen and love music. So you can get it in some parts of France, like in Paris, but you can basically get it on the internet. And the wonderful thing about it is that, A, you've got no idea what's coming next. B, that 80, 90% of what they play, I've never heard. So I'm always looking to hear new stuff. I don't really see the point in listening to stuff I know, because it's in my head now and I don't need to listen to it. I have my very, very, very favourite songs, but I think that music is magic. I mean, music is magic. It transforms one thing to another. It's extraordinary, powerful magic. The only way you can sort of destroy its power is by overuse. I don't like particularly going into restaurants that play music, and everywhere that play, supermarkets that play music. If it's bad music, I want them to turn it off. If it's good music, I want to stop what I'm doing and listen to it. You know, it's like, I hate background music. So, but my very favourite songs, which have a kind of, they're special for me. They have this, I save them for the moments that I need them. Does that make sense? There'll be a favourite song. I know that in a certain moment, I really need to hear that. And when it's not that moment, I save it. You know, so you don't overuse the magic.
Yeah. Which one is one of these favourites?
Oh, what are favourites? Oh, really, lots of different things. I think this is my favourite rock album of all time, is Quadrophenia. And I go back to that every now and again. That's a wonderful combination of beauty and violence. Lots of just really eclectic, actually. This Woman's Work by Kate Bush, the most emotional piece of music ever created, but I save it for the moments that I need it the most. Really lots of different things. Lots of, you know, all genres, classical and metal and reggae and pop. And my first love really is soul music. I grew up, I'm 65, so I grew up in the 60s. Wonderful time to grow up with music, because on one side of the Atlantic there was the Beatles and the Stones and the Who and the Kinks. And on the other side of the Atlantic, you've got Atlantic Soul and Tamla Motown. Tamla Motown, I think, is the sort of high point of Western culture, you know, starting with the Renaissance. I have a theory that Western culture started its long decline in 1970 when Berry Gordy moved Motown Records from Detroit to Los Angeles, because the reasons he moved it were greed and vanity, which is what will undo Western culture, greed and vanity.
Is there also a genre you don't appreciate to listen to?
Not really. I'm not big on jazz, and Phipp does play a lot of jazz, but within everything, I'll find stuff I like. So do I listen to sort of avant-garde jazz? No. But do I like a lot of the things that's influenced by jazz? Oh, also Amy Winehouse, for a start off. Yeah, massively. So Billie Holiday, wonderful. You know, this, lots of things which are... but I'm not very good at esoteric music. I think that music, you've either you want to listen to the singer and sing along, or else you want to dance to it. And if it's neither, I'm not so interested, you know.
What about mainstream pop? You like that?
Occasionally.
Imagine. Really?
Occasionally, less and less. I think the problem with mainstream pop is that the necessity of the machines, so everything is in tune and it's in time, and everything, you know, it's a computer that dictates the speed of the track, so everything's perfectly in time. I think one of the sad things that's happened to music is the tuner. Because in all the old records that we all know and love, made in the 60s, everybody would gather around the piano, they'd get approximately in tune, and they'd play. But there'd be quite a lot of discrepancy between the instruments. As you have in an orchestra, you have all the instruments, but especially with violins, because there's no frets, you know, everybody's very slightly out of tune with each other, which gives a kind of depth to the music. When everything's perfectly in tune, first of all, it makes the music much more limited. Secondly, the singer's got nowhere to go, because if the singer is slightly out of tune, the singer suddenly sounds wrong. Whereas in the old days, the singer was protected because everybody was a bit out of tune. Now they tune the singer. So, the tyranny of the auto-tune. And I really don't like, you know, the modern pop style of auto-tuning singers. I don't like it. I want a human voice to sound human. It's just a sort of basic sort of thing. But having said that, every now and again I hear a piece of pop and I go, I love that. It's a little bit like food. You can never tell people what they should like. I mean, there's lots of food that I know it's good for me, but I don't like it, you know. And the same with music. There's lots of music. I know it's brilliant. I have total respect. But do I want to listen to it? No. And then there's, you know, then there's food that we know is bad for us. It's cheap shit made for money. Just like there's lots of music out there that's cheap copies of copies of copies made for money. But occasionally you go, oh, God, it's good though, isn't it? You know, we've all got records like that.
Sometimes fish and chips.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Justin Sullivan. Thanks for being here and thanks for playing us. And we're looking forward to see you and hearing you tonight in the Suit House.
Are you going to come along tonight?
Of course.
Okay.
We will. Thank you.
It would just be me. It's just that and me talking. But yeah, okay.
We're really looking forward to hear you.
Okay, good.
Thank you for being here and take care.
And pleasure.
See you next time.